You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear the story of a Wisconsin teacher at the center of a back-and-forth debate in the race for governor. First, whenever someone dies of unknown causes in your area, it's up to the local coroner and or medical examiner to establish what that cause could be. It's an important job, but many in the field around the country are feeling the stress of overwork and low staffing. While some are calling for changes to help out, it's made difficult because there's a patchwork of procedures for how death investigations are handled around the country. Maddie Quinn is a staff writer covering health for Governing Magazine. Her recent piece on this is called Dead Reckoning. Maddie, welcome to Central Time.
I'm happy to do it.
Well, before we get into some of the issues with coroners and medical examiners, let's talk about what they are, because I think a lot of people, myself included, have used those as synonyms sometimes, but they're different. Can you tell us how they're different?
Right. So a coroner is an elected official who completes an investigation after any sort of sudden death. So a medical examiner, on the other hand, is someone who handles the actual autopsy side of things, you know, toxicology tests, things like that. And so depending on where you live, however, a coroner could be doing both of those things, or a medical examiner could be doing both of those things, because some states just have coroners, some states just have medical examiners, and others have a mix of both. 16 states and D.C. now only have medical examiners, 11 just have coroners, and the rest have a mix of both. And Wisconsin is one of those states that has a mix of both.
And a strange thing is, I mean, coroners are appointed. In some places, they're elected. You don't necessarily have to know anything about medicine and the human body, right, to get that gig.
Right. I mean, they're almost overwhelmingly elected. So, you know, a coroner, depending on where you live, is just someone who won a local election, whereas a medical examiner is somebody that has a medical degree.
And before we get into the problems that communities are having here and the resources that these have, why are these important jobs? Why should we be worried if they're under-resourced?
Right. So a lot of people see it just, you know, as a helping profession. These are people who help people in their communities get closure on deaths. So that's one thing. And the other thing is that they're on the front lines of public health. You know, these are the people who are doing death investigations are really on the front lines of spotting new epidemics and new diseases that are cropping up in communities.
Right. This is our first indication that there's a new disease, or it could be nowadays, this is our first indication that there's a new kind of really lethal fentanyl in the community, something
exactly.
Like that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's a huge piece of it nowadays. Someone I spoke to also said that the medical examiners in New Mexico were noticing people dying very strangely, and they pinpointed it to deer mice urine, and people were coming in contact with that and dying. And so when you don't have enough of these qualified people in these offices, you're not going to notice things like that.
And you point out in your piece, people might have an impression of medical examiners in particular from TV, where there's these high-tech labs, super well-resourced, and they're solving all these problems. What does reality look like for a lot of coroners and medical examiners?
Right. So there are only 500 board-certified forensic pathologists in the United States today, and that is less than half of what the National Association of Medical Examiners recommends. And even beyond that, that was the association said that we needed about 1,000 prior to the opioid epidemic. And so there are just not that many people, qualified people in these offices. Yeah, and quite frankly, there have been several instances of offices losing accreditation just because they don't have enough people. I know the Connecticut Office of the Medical Examiner lost its accreditation. The statewide office lost its accreditation for a short period of time last year because there weren't enough people to handle the number of bodies that were coming in.
And looking at the problem, if I'm a doctor coming out of medical school, I've got a lot of loans probably. Is this an attractive line of work for me?
Nope. And honestly, the people I spoke to were very upfront about it. You know, these medical examiners, you know, these county and state level medical examiners that I spoke to, they were very honest about it. They were like, look, why is somebody with $150,000 in debt going to go into a job working for the state making $70,000? It just doesn't make any sense. And yes, it is, you know, I'm sure it can be a very exciting job where you learn a lot, but you're just not going to be making the amount of money that you should be making, or that you could make in a private practice.
Talking to Maddie Quinn from Governing Magazine about a resource problem facing coroners and medical examiners' offices around the country. And Maddie, literally, I don't want to be gruesome here, but in some cases, you write, there are literally bodies piling up because of this resource problem.
Right. Yeah. And a lot of it, part of that is of the lack of resources, but part of it is there are just more people. It just kind of goes back to the opioid epidemic. There are more people dying in ways that need to be investigated. And these offices just don't have the space, let alone the number of people to handle it.
So I should ask, when does a coroner or medical examiner get involved in a death, in investigating it?
You know, it's sort of a very loose definition. It's basically any death that is considered sudden. So, you know, somebody in a hospice care is not going to need a coroner or medical investigator to come in. But so it's anything that might be considered sudden that no one foresaw is going to be when a coroner or medical examiner is going to come in. And there isn't really, I wasn't able to find a more specific definition other than that.
So it's kind of vague.
Yeah, my understanding of that it's still pretty vague.
But getting back to that opioid epidemic, that could be a big problem because with an overdose death, that is in that category of a sudden unexpected death, that would drive a lot more activity at these offices.
Right. And I have heard in a lot of places, people are just foregoing the toxicology part of it just because, you know, if somebody, you know, fits a certain mold, you know, like we're just going to go ahead and say that it was a drug overdose and just kind of mark that box and not go through the toxicology test just because we don't have the time and space and resources to do it.
Okay, now that sounds scary because if I'm in law enforcement or health, I want to know if there's a new, different kind, more lethal or unpredictable form of opioid in the community I serve.
Right. And it's just, I don't know if it happens all of the time, but there are certain places that in certain circumstances, if people don't have time, they're just kind of, you know, checking the box and moving it along.
Okay. So people in the professions anyway are seeing a problem here. Are legislators in states around the country, say, or even at the national level, paying attention?
Not that I've found. And I will tell you, almost everyone that I spoke to was so relieved that I was writing about this because, you know, they told me this is a huge problem in our profession and more lawmakers there aren't enough lawmakers listening to us. And I spoke to one of my favorite sources. He was the former medical examiner for the state of Kentucky. And he told me, you know, back when he was doing his job, he was in this role a while ago. He was speaking to a lawmaker and he was trying to lobby for more resources and more money. And the lawmaker said that people don't vote. And, you know, his response to that was like, no, but their relatives do. So this is something you should care about. This is really not something that's on lawmakers' radar right now, which, you know, when you consider the opioid epidemic, it really, really should be.
In talking to people in these coroners and medical examiners' offices for this piece, did you get the sense that this is a slow burn problem that's been growing for a long time, or are we kind of suddenly seeing a crisis come out of nowhere?
I think it's one of those things where it was a slow buildup and then it was sort of the slow build and then everything kind of happened at once. I think people have been aware for a long time that there just aren't enough people going into forensic pathology and, you know, wanting to work in medical examiner's offices, and the opioid epidemic just really, really made that, you know, all the more prevalent or all the more noticeable.
You write that there have been calls for changes, including getting rid of coroners altogether, going to a medical examiner only setup. Who's calling for that and why?
Right. So the National Academy of Sciences said that in 2009, so, you know, before the opioid epidemic, the National Academy of Sciences, you know, said that we should just completely abolish the office of the coroner and just go to a medical examiner model. Most people that I spoke to, including medical examiners, are really ambivalent about that. They said, you know, coroners have been around since the 1600s, you know, completely abolishing that office is not going to do a lot. What we just need more resources and we need more people who want to get involved in these professions, you know, whether they are a coroner who making coroners have that medical background or requiring them to have that background or, you know, we just need more resources. We don't necessarily need to just abolish this one system.
On kind of a side note, you found that some coroners, people worried that they had a conflict of interest because of other roles they played. What did you find?
Right. So I could have written a whole other story about this, but in California in particular, most counties in California, the coroner is also the sheriff, which, you know, that opens up a whole other can of worms. And, you know, just in doing a little bit of research, you can find several instances in the past, you know, just couple of years of medical examiners getting fired because, you know, they refused to change the cause of death that the coroner or the coroner sheriff, you know, asked them to. So, you know, when you have law enforcement who is in charge of, you know, making those decisions on how someone dies, that that can kind of be icky, you know, that's not ideal. And most people I spoke to said that it is a huge conflict of interest.
As we wrap up, you mentioned a few moments ago, people were relieved that you were talking to them. Did this seem to a lot of people like an under the radar problem?
Yeah, definitely. Very under the radar. And like I said, in the midst of the opioid epidemic, when, you know, there are bodies, you know, being stacked in these offices, there's just a real desire that these professions have this, they need help and they need resources and they want lawmakers, you know, to listen to them.
We'll leave it there for now. Maddie, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Maddie Quinn is a staff writer covering health for Governing Magazine. Her recent piece on the coroner and medical examiner field is called Dead Reckoning. If you're following the race for governor between Scott Walker and Tony Evers, you've probably heard about the teacher who looked at porn at school in 2010. At issue is whether Evers, as the state superintendent of public instruction, should have or could have done anything about it. The night Evers won the Democratic primary, the Republican Party of Wisconsin rolled out a TV ad saying Evers failed to protect kids.
A teacher viewed and shared pornographic material at school. Tony Evers knew about it. The same teacher made sexual remarks about the bodies of middle school girls. Evers knew that too. Yet, despite calls from parents and school officials, Tony Evers sided with the union and refused to revoke the teacher's license. As superintendent of public instruction, Tony Evers is supposed to keep our children safe. But he didn't.
About a week later, the Greater Wisconsin Committee responded with an ad of its own.
Would you trust a career politician or a lifelong educator? After 25 years in office, Scott Walker is desperate to stay in power. So he's attacking Tony Evers and not telling the truth. Tony Evers would never put our children at risk. When the law stopped Tony Evers from revoking a teacher's license for viewing pornography, Tony worked with lawmakers from both parties to change the law so offenders could be kicked out of the classroom. Tony Evers, putting our children's safety and the truth first.
So what's the story behind this political controversy? Molly Beck is the state capitol reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She talked earlier with Judith Sears Poisson.
So who is this teacher who is at the center of this controversy?
So his name is Andrew Harris, and he's a middle school teacher in the Middleton Cross Plains School District. And at the time of this incident, he was caught with about six or seven other teachers looking at pornographic material over about a year's time.
And so this was an ongoing issue. And was he viewing this pornography in the classroom or in the teacher's lounge? Do we know where it was going on?
I believe he was. It might have been in the classroom, but the crux of this whole case is that no children were ever around him when he was looking at it. I believe they were able to prove that he was only looking at this, you know, during a planning period or when he had some off time. It was never during a class.
And how did he get caught, or how did they get caught?
So there was another teacher who was. They had kind of a teacher group that where they planned together, and a female teacher in that group, he showed her a picture of a woman's genitalia, and she complained to supervisors about that. And because of that complaint, the district decided to investigate his, you know, internet and computer use and email use, and also did a district-wide investigation, which is how they discovered there were other teachers doing the same thing.
And so what was the punishment for Harris and for the other people who were reviewing it?
So Harris was, they recommended that he be fired, and the other teachers who were found to be doing similar things, the discipline ranged from a reprimand to, you know, a few days of suspension. And that is why this case became such a flashpoint in the Middleton community, because Andrew Harris appealed that discipline, and he did so because he argued that his discipline was much worse than the other teachers, even though they were found doing similar things.
But he was actually the one that was receiving it from someone else and then showing it to others. So in a way, it seems like it could be argued that if it were not for him, none of the others would have been viewing it.
And that's what the district argued at the time. The superintendent at the time, Don Johnson, he's no longer there, but at the time he said that he believed Harris's conduct was worse than the other teachers, and that's why the discipline was worse.
So Tony Evers, who is currently the state superintendent of public instruction, running for governor now, he was the superintendent at that point as well. He says that he objected to Harris's behavior, but that he could not revoke the license for him to teach because state law didn't allow him to do it. What was state law at that time? What year are we talking about?
So we're talking about 2008, 2009. That's when he began looking at this material and ultimately when the investigation began, when the complaint was filed, was in 2009. And at that time, the law that governs when the state superintendent can initiate proceedings to revoke a teacher's license, that law said that a teacher must have engaged in what's known as immoral conduct. And at that time, it was defined as conduct that endangered students, and that is the crucial part of that, and the reason that Tony Evers says he could not have revoked Andrew Harris's license because he did not expose any of that material to students. Right after that case, and I believe this case is what prompted lawmakers to look at that law. They changed the definition of that immoral conduct statute, and now State Superintendent Evers and anyone that comes after him can revoke a license just for looking at things like that using classroom.
So given that that was the law at the time, what is it that Governor Walker and his supporters are saying that Tony Evers should have done as the superintendent of public instruction?
So Governor Walker, at the time, he initially told a parent who had complained and asked the governor to intervene and asked the state superintendent to revoke the license. He initially said this is a school board matter, but then after hearing more about it, he sent a letter to State Superintendent Evers saying that he believes that Harris's conduct did meet the immoral conduct definition and that he should revoke the license. And now he is saying that even if, the definition is being interpreted as not being applicable to this situation, he should have tried to revoke the license anyway, and if it ended up in court, then it ended up in court.
We're talking with Molly Beck right now. She's the state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and we're digging into a back and forth going on between the Walker campaign and the Evers campaign about a case of a Middleton teacher who was found to be viewing pornography at school, but was not showing the pornography to students, and whether his license to teach should have been revoked. So as you said, Molly, it sounds like the key here is that students were not actually shown the pornographic material or exposed to it, and that requirement as part of a burden of proof to be met for revocation of licenses was changed. So is there anything that can be done retroactively in this case because Harris is still teaching, correct?
Right. He's still a middle school science teacher in the Middleton Cross Plains School District. And I should note that though the district spent a lot of money and, a few years trying to fire Harris because of this, they now fully support him and back him and say that the case was never about whether or not students were endangered. But there's nothing that can happen retroactively from Evers' position. He's saying that I can't apply a law to an incident that happened, before the law existed. He couldn't do that.
What was the response of parents and colleagues when Harris came back to teaching in Middleton?
At the time, he was gone for about 4 years while all this was playing out in court. When he came back, there was a pretty vocal, I don't remember how many parents there were, but there were quite a few, and to the point that it got some news coverage, and I was covering education at the time for the Wisconsin State Journal, so I was covering this case at the time. And when Andrew Harris was returning to class, the district actually put him in a different middle school than where he was when this happened. And there were some pretty angry parents about it, and the district initially tried to offer those parents a study hall that they could send their kids to if their kids were assigned to Harris as a teacher. But DPI actually stepped in that case too and said, you can't do that. You have to teach kids science, so you can't just offer them a study hall.
And finally, as we wrap up, Molly, is this issue and these ads resonating with the voters?
It's tough to say at this point. I think the next round of polling from the Marquette University Law School polls, I mean, that might be give us an indication of whether these attacks and these ads and this whole case is resonating with voters in terms of if they think Tony Evers acted appropriately, or maybe they think the Republicans, they don't like these ads on TV. Maybe they think they're going too far. We'll see. We'll see how it shakes out.
Well, Molly, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Molly Beck is a state capitol reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She talked to Judith Sears Poisson about a Middleton teacher who had viewed pornography at school and is now at the center of Wisconsin's race for governor. The Federal Education Department has been working on changes to campus sexual misconduct rules since last year when Betsy DeVos took over as secretary. Last week, the New York Times got a hold of draft copies of some of those proposed changes. In the past, DeVos has raised concerns about students who have been accused of sexual misconduct, worrying that their rights haven't always been respected. Here she is talking about this on Fox News last year.
Let me just say that one sexual assault on campus is one too many, but one person denied due process is one too many, and that's really what this is all about. We really need to get to a point where it's fair for all students and where it is clear what the process is for all students.
In a few minutes, we'll talk to a reporter who covers higher education about the proposed changes. First, Alicia Johnson is with us, director of the Women's Center at UW Oshkosh. Alicia, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, my understanding, Alicia, is that schools have been in limbo in some ways since Obama-era guidelines were ended, and now we're waiting for these new guidelines. What has that meant for you at UW Oshkosh?
At UW Oshkosh, we continue to uphold the policies, both at the system level, the state level, and the federal, as the guidelines stand currently. So continuing those fair processes that we have in place.
So talk about how that actually works in practice for students who are now returning to school this week.
Yeah, so we have the ability to make several accommodations. If we have a person who has reported a sexual assault and that their perpetrator is on campus, we can make several accommodations, whether it's changing residence halls or if there's a no-contact order, helping support that, and making sure that everyone's voices are heard throughout the process.
And now watching these changes and the reporting about them, they're not in place yet. These are draft changes. As you look at them, what do you think? What do you hope for? What are you worried about?
I continue to be disheartened by the focus on the false accusations rather than the large percentage of people who are experiencing sexual assault. And I think that focus on the false accusations continues to perpetuate a culture that tells people who are victims or survivors of sexual assault that they're perhaps less important. And I think that's part of why people don't report at the rate we hope they would, so that they can be connected to the resources they need to be successful, both in their personal lives and in their academic lives.
And before I let you go, Alicia, what do you see long-term when it comes to the climate on campus, both in preventing harassment and assault in the first place and making sure that it's reported when it happens and that those reports are taken seriously?
One approach that we're taking is to take on the hard conversations, help people understand what actually is or constitutes sexual misconduct, how they can have healthy relationships, both romantically and sexually with partners, and just really trying to get to the root of the problem so that we prevent the assaults from happening in the first place.
Alicia, thanks for taking the time on this holiday.
All right, thank you.
That's Alicia Johnson, director of the Women's Center at UW Oshkosh. Sarah Brown joins us now with the details of potential rule changes at the federal level. She's a reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Sarah, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, big picture, in this draft that the New York Times got a hold of, what are some of the key changes as you read them?
So the first thing is that this is a version of the drafted regulations. That's important to keep in mind because these have not been published yet. We don't know if this is the final version of the regulations that the department is going to propose. But we had been expecting, sort of in the higher ed world, that these were going to come this fall. And so my sense is that these are pretty close to what is going to come out when the department eventually publishes these. So one of the really hot button issues that was addressed in these regulations is the question of how these sexual assault cases are adjudicated. So what standard of evidence colleges use to determine whether or not a student or an employee committed sexual assault or harassment. These regulations would allow colleges to choose which standard of evidence they use. So they can either use the preponderance of evidence, which is more likely than not that the sexual misconduct occurred, or a higher standard, clear and convincing. That is a change from the Obama administration, which had effectively told colleges you must use that preponderance of evidence standard, that lower standard. So now colleges have a choice. That's one really big one. Another big one that is worth pointing out is a narrower definition of sexual harassment. So under the Obama administration, the Education Department defined sexual harassment as any unwelcome conduct of a sexual nature. Now the definition says unwelcome sexual conduct that is, quote, so severe and pervasive and objectively offensive that it denies access to a school's education program or activity. So the idea is that the definition is a bit narrower now for what constitutes sexual harassment. So those are a couple of the key changes, and we can get into the other ones later in the hour.
I want to step back and look at the big picture. How much control does the federal government have, the Department of Education have, in setting the guidelines that are in practice at universities and colleges around the country?
Right. So what we're talking about here is Title IX, which is the federal gender equity law. Under that law, colleges and universities must respond to sexual misconduct because that behavior can deny people access to deny educational access to people. That is why colleges and universities, part of why they are obligated to respond to sexual misconduct. The punishment for violating Title IX and for ostensibly not promptly and equitably responding to sexual misconduct is the federal government can withdraw all federal funds. Now, we're talking tens, hundreds of millions of dollars, financial aid, all of that. So that's a big punishment. That has never happened. There have been colleges investigated and punished for violating Title, or investigated and told they violated Title IX, but the Education Department has never levied that really substantial punishment of withdrawing federal funds. But that threat is always there. Some of it is a sort of public relations thing. You know, colleges, if the Ed Department is announcing that a college violated Title IX for not adequately handling sexual misconduct, that looks really, really bad on a college campus. So we're really talking here about Title IX, civil rights law, and the Education Department does have a significant amount of authority, even if they haven't levied that major punishment of withdrawing all federal funds here.
You'd mentioned the new guidelines put in under the Obama administration, and Education Secretary now under the Trump administration, Betsy DeVos, has been critical of those, as we heard, worried that they're not protecting the accused students, but also the idea that they're creating, those guidelines created these huge bureaucratic hurdles for universities and colleges. When you talk to people around the country who work in these fields, were those concerns, did they see these concerns as valid?
Sure. I did hear those concerns. I think that, you know, it's fair to say that colleges and universities do want to take sexual misconduct seriously. You know, I don't think anybody would say we don't want to respond, you know, equitably to sexual assault and harassment. But I did hear, I definitely heard some concern about sort of a blanket application of guidance to colleges, no matter what size, no matter the level of resources that a college has. So, you know, it seemed like everyone from a, you know, major public university to a tiny community college was having to be held to the same standard. And I think bottom line is that colleges definitely do they, I think, you know, my sense of here talking to people on campuses is that they want to take this issue seriously, what, and they want to comply with Title IX, they want to respond to sexual assault. What that looks like may vary depending on the type of campus and how big the campus is. But of course, the concerns that many critics are raising is that if the federal government is lessening its aggressive enforcement of Title IX, that colleges will not take sexual misconduct as seriously, and they may go back to a world where they are sweeping these cases under the rug. And that's something that really triggered a lot of the you know, activism that we saw from students, especially in trying to force colleges to change their policies. It was students saying, colleges mishandled my sexual assault case. So, yeah.
Well, these stories in national headlines, the Michigan State story, this ongoing situation with another athletic doctor now at Ohio State and others around the country. Are people pointing to those and saying, hey, if we back off, are we going to not detect these horrific long-term abuses?
Absolutely. So the current climate is really important to keep in mind, because not only do we have things like Michigan State University and the Larry Nassar scandal, which I'm sure everybody is familiar with, colleges are wondering, could this happen here? Could we be allowing, you know, a predator to prey on victims on our campus for decades? I mean, it's horrifying. There's also the backdrop of the Me Too movement, which is also an important factor here. And in academia, the way that's played out in particular is that more people have been coming forward about star professors who sexually harass them. So there's certainly a lot of scrutiny on colleges and on every industry right now for how they deal with sexual misconduct. But given things like Michigan State, Ohio State, the Me Too movement, colleges are really on edge right now. And it certainly wouldn't look good to scale back a commitment to sexual misconduct.
We're talking to Sarah Brown from the Chronicle of Higher Education about a draft of proposed changes to rules on campus sexual assault and harassment. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you starting college this week? Is your kid? Do you worry about these issues? Are you paying attention to these federal guidelines? What do you think about the changes you're hearing about? How do we strike the right balance for students who are victims and protecting the rights of students who have been accused? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. We continue our conversation with Sarah Brown from the Chronicle of Higher Education on proposed changes to policies dealing with rape and sexual assault on school campuses, harassment as well. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions about these changes. Are you in college yourself? Do you work on campus? Are you a parent with a child headed back to class this week? What do you think about the way schools treat these issues? Is this a worry for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Sarah, other changes in this draft, again, not a done deal, in this draft that struck you as significant?
Sure. So one, for example, is the fact that colleges and universities will ostensibly now only be held accountable for formal complaints of sexual misconduct. And formal complaint means a report that is made to a, quote, official who has the authority to institute corrective measures. So that's someone like, you know, a manager, a senior administrator, but not somebody like a professor or a resident advisor in a dorm. That's significant because on many, if not most campuses, there are mandatory reporting policies now where any employee of the university that hears about sexual misconduct, whether it's, you know, a student just dropping by after class, wants to talk about things, they have to report that to the Title IX office, and that triggers a response from the office. So if only formal complaints are what colleges are being held accountable for, that might upend a lot of the policies and structures that colleges have put in place over the last few years. So that was pretty significant to me. Another point is that apparently colleges will only be held accountable for investigating sexual misconduct on campus and in college or university programs, but not off campus in places like, you know, off campus student apartments. That also seemed significant to me and to the folks that I was talking to. And then the last thing I'll mention is if you're thinking about sort of these campus hearings where sexual misconduct cases are adjudicated, the Obama administration discouraged cross-examination. So victims and accused students cross-examining each other about the incident. These guidelines or these regulations would ostensibly allow both students to cross-examine each other and request evidence from each other. The Obama administration had said that that was re-traumatizing potentially to victims, but that is apparently something that will be allowed under the new regulations if this is sort of what makes it into the final form.
On that last point, what kind of reactions have you been hearing from people at universities that you've talked to?
So I think a lot of colleges have, as you mentioned, been in limbo for the past year, and a lot of them are still kind of waiting to see, first of all, what comes in, what is actually published in terms of regulations, because, again, right now all we have is what the New York Times reported. We haven't even seen a document yet. I think, you know, most colleges, the officials that I've talked to have not changed their policies substantially from what they put in place during the Obama administration. And I'm sure that there are colleges, and I have heard this, that I'm sure there are colleges that are looking for a reason to potentially spend a little bit less money, time, effort, resources on Title IX compliance, which is very expensive. But my sense in talking to my sources is that they are staying the course, they are keeping the policies and procedures that they have in place, and most of them are in line with the way that the Obama administration governed things. And I think for the time being, that's probably what we're going to continue seeing on campuses. My sources tell me there might be some quote-unquote early adopters who might test the waters and see, okay, if this is the DeVos approach to you know, sexual misconduct and adjudicating these cases, maybe we'll try something a little bit different. But we'll have to wait and see if that's what transpires.
Talking to Sarah Brown from the Chronicle of Higher Education about a draft of potential changes to federal sexual harassment and assault policy and guidelines for college campuses. Sarah, is there wiggle room for campuses who say, yes, lovely, thanks for the advice, we want to go a step further, we want to keep higher standards, maybe more in line with the Obama administration directives? Could they do that?
So I think it's unclear right now what exactly, you know, one of my sources talked to me about whether these regulations are prescriptive versus permissive, and whether they will be sort of ironclad rules or whether they will give colleges sort of flexibility and choice. And, you know, my sense coming out of the DeVos Education Department is that she's been much more on the side of giving colleges choices. Another important thing to point out is that there are actually quite a number of state laws out there that have codified a lot of the Obama administration's approach to adjudicating sexual misconduct cases on campuses. And so in California, for example, the standards are that the Obama administration put in its guidance are now codified. Many of them are codified into a law. So colleges have to follow those laws. And so I think, you know, what we might end up seeing is a sort of patchwork of policies where it, depending on the state, the sort of guidelines for colleges and universities are going to be a little bit different. And I actually think, you know, and what my sources are telling me is that we might see more states enacting potentially higher standards for more specific standards for how colleges should handle these cases. So we'll have to wait and see if that transpires in the months to come.
Now, if I'm a university administrator and my state government's telling me one thing and these federal guidelines are saying something different, I mean, it sounds like that's the sort of thing that could end up in court.
Sure. It's a complicated, very complicated landscape. And actually, the courts are playing an important role here, because one thing that we are seeing a lot more of, especially since the new administration took power, is lawsuits being brought by students who were accused of sexual misconduct. So, you know, you mentioned how Betsy DeVos has been very concerned about false accusations or people who were, you know, suspended or expelled from school for crimes that they allegedly didn't commit. And so we are seeing a lot more lawsuits against colleges for allegedly, you know, not giving a student who was accused enough due process, not handling the case right for, you know, and so I think we're going to continue to see just more and more litigation in this space, whether it's from accused students or whether it's from sexual assault victims who are continuing to try to hold colleges accountable for this, for handling these cases properly.
Was there a sense, especially with the Obama administration guidelines, that the federal government had to do something to protect colleges and universities from themselves, with the temptation maybe in that Michigan State case, the Jerry Sandusky case, a prominent star professor being accused that, yeah, they don't want sexual harassment, they don't want sexual assault, but they're also worried about their reputation and they don't want to air their dirty laundry?
Sure. And that was definitely the concern that also a lot of students brought up. So the Obama administration's sort of more aggressive enforcement of Title IX coincided with a lot of students who were pressuring both the education department to hold colleges accountable and for colleges to really step it up. So students were going to the press. They were telling their stories of being sexually assaulted and how the university, you know, didn't handle their case properly, didn't help them, didn't, you know, help them change classes, didn't help them move dorms and that sort of stuff. And so, you know, it's, again, I think that most colleges, you know, you're not going to find colleges who are going to say, we don't want to take this issue seriously. But, you know, the thought that a lot of activists have had is that we need to leverage these sort of outside means of holding colleges accountable, whether it's through the federal government, through the courts, through state laws, whatever it may be.
As we wrap up, Sarah, is there an idea of when the final report, the final recommendations are going to come out from the Department of Education?
So it has to, first of all, they have to be published. We haven't actually seen a document yet of these regulations. Then once they're published, they have to go through a notice and comment period. This was something that was important for DeVos. She said, you know, the Obama administration handed down these mandates on colleges by, quote unquote, administrative fiat. And I want to go through a process of engaging with the public about these issues. And so that's what the notice and comment process will do. Then the regulations will be revised and then published. So we could be looking at months, at the very least months. And so I think for the time being, a lot of colleges will stay the course with what they've been doing and eagerly awaiting to see what comes out of the education department.
Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Sarah Brown, reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. She was with us today to talk about new drafted regulations from the Education Department, reported on by the New York Times, that would change the way schools deal with sexual misconduct on campuses.